Impact, a continuing series of talks based on modern and ancient wisdom. And here is our host, Dr. Anil Mehta, at the Bakersfield Chinmaya Mission.
Today's subject is very ancient and at the same time very modern, very practical. The topic is Vedanta in the modern age. So this word Vedanta, some of you may be familiar with, majority are not. So the Vedas are the spiritual textbooks of India, of Hinduism. And these were composed or told or written several thousand years ago, about 8,000 years ago. The spirit texts were composed, and there is no one particular author. There is not one like Jesus gave us the Bible, Muhammad gave us the Quran, Buddha gave us the teachings. These were not the teachings of one saint or one prophet or one master, but over few thousand years, different teachers gave different ideas, which were then compiled into four Vedas or the four texts. Now, the majority of the information in the Vedas talks about nature, about glorification of nature, because the ancients, they worship nature, the natural elements, and also talks about the rituals, how one can do different rituals for prayers. But at the end of each of the four Vedas were a series of texts which were called Upanishads. So Veda, Anta. Anta means the end. So at the end of the Vedas, some people also describe end as being the goal of the Vedas. The highest knowledge of the Vedas was in the end of the Vedas, where after a person has prepared his or her mind with rituals and with worshipping nature, worshipping the Lord, he or she is then ready for the highest knowledge. And this knowledge was called the Upanishads. And we have some of the Upanishads. There are more than 108 Upanishads, but some of the major ones, the commentaries have been written by our teacher, Swami Chinmayananda, our master, and these are available in the bookstore. So the Upanishads contain the highest knowledge of the Vedas. The Upanishads contain the highest knowledge of the Vedas. Highest knowledge of the Vedas. And they talk about, who am I? Who is this God? And what is my relationship with Him? So that is the essential knowledge of the Upanishads. And this knowledge was given to us several thousand years ago. And over a period, this knowledge got lost. It was preserved in the text, but people were not studying it, they were not practicing it. But in the last 100 years, we have found that, or in the last few hundred years, several great masters have revived this knowledge, made it available, have made that knowledge available to every individual. It has been translated in English by Swami Vivekananda, and our own master, the founder, Swami Chinmayananda, and in the modern age, even people like Eckhart Tolle and all have tried to make this knowledge easier and available to understand. So how can we apply this 8,000-year-old knowledge into our lives today? I shall try to do that. This subject, of course, can take days or weeks, but maybe in about 20 or 25 minutes, I'll try to give a little bit of what this knowledge is and how it can help us in our present-day life. And then these ideas I have been giving those who have been coming to these classes for the past few years, I have been using these ideas from the Vedas and the Upanishads without identifying them, but today I'm trying to give us the source. So this knowledge is relevant, but first we need to know, why should I study this knowledge? What is the benefit for me? The world seems to be going okay. We have lot of prosperity, we have wealth, we have all the comforts, our houses are air conditioned and heated, We have cars, we have planes, we have satellites, we can communicate with anybody in the, any part of the world. You know, we have discovered, we have to some extent conquered nature. Even now we are conquering space, traveling into different planets. And we find that people are relatively wealthier and more comfortable than they were, say, 500 years ago, or even 100, 200 years ago. The standard of living which an ordinary individual can enjoy is far greater than what our grandparents could even envision, could even imagine. And they always used to think, you know, how wonderful it would be if we had all these comforts. And we find that we have all these comforts. Life in general is fairly comfortable. We have whatever we, most of the time we have what we need. But are we really happy? Is man really happier now than he was 100 years ago or 200 years ago? We find that despite all this prosperity, despite all this wealth, despite all this comfort, we are still unhappy. Previously, we were uncomfortably unhappy. Now we are comfortably unhappy. That is the only difference. And we find that problems are continuing to grow and multiply. You know, wars are going on all over the world, and you know, so much conflict and so much, you know, sorrow. And we find that more and more people are taking psychiatric medicines and heavy-duty pain medicines, and people are living in a dull stupor, you know, and it's not only, you know, people who are on drugs, but now these legitimately prescribed drugs by doctors are so potent that they are far more potent than heroin and all the, you know, marijuana and all that. And people are just eating them like candy, and we find there is so much sorrow. And, you know, various new theories come out, new economic theories and political theories, and, you know, communism came, and then socialism came, and then capitalism, and each one promises that with this, the world will become happier, the world will change, and we find that it has not happened. And then people have this idea that wealth can buy happiness. And as we can see, you know, in the examples of people who were so wealthy, Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley, Marilyn Monroe, Howard Hughes, these were people who were billionaires, who had so much money that they could never have spent it. And they all lived, they died lives of misery. They either committed suicide or died in alone or died in sorrow. And why is that? Because we have placed our happiness in something where it is not. And in that process, man thinks that my circumstances rule me. And that is how, from childhood, we are conditioned. You know, if everything is okay in your life, if you are comfortable financially, and you know, you are married, and you have children, and you have a nice job, then everything will be fine. You'll have a nice house, you know, by the country club, and you'll have a nice car. And so, thinking that circumstances will make me happy, we let the circumstances rule us. The situations control us. That by changing my situation in the world, I can become happy. And then we try all different ways. Person doesn't like the neighborhood, so moves to a new house. Doesn't like his job. You know, they say an average person changes his home, you know, and in America, 7 times in his lifetime, probably more. We don't like our wife, so we change the wife. You know, don't like the job, change the job. And we are constantly thinking that by adjusting my situation, I can become happy. So what we are doing is we're letting the circumstances control us. But our Vedantic masters in the Upanishad said, I should be in charge of my circumstances. Humans should control their circumstances. Do not let circumstances control them. Now, how can I do that? How can I control what is happening in my surroundings, in my neighborhood, in my country, in my world, in nature? So they say there is a way. You may not be able to control nature, but each person is responsible for his or her own situation, his or own circumstances, his or her own happiness. Our founder Swami Chinmayananda always said, he said, do not put the key of your happiness in somebody else's pocket. Could be a person or could be a situation, that if this situation is there, I'm happy. If this person smiled at me today, I'm happy. If this object I got, I'm happy. So it says, you are in charge of your own happiness. You are in charge of your own circumstances. Then there is a very beautiful saying. It says, you cannot get milk from a wooden cow. No matter how beautiful the cow looks, how realistic and how you paint it, you cannot, because it is not the nature of a wooden cow to give milk. And similarly, it is not the nature of the world to give us happiness. But expecting the world to give us happiness, we constantly pursue happiness. And in that process, we compete and we steal from others, and you know, countries steal from other countries, people steal from other people. Why? Because we have put our happiness somewhere where it is not. And no matter how hard you try, the world cannot give you happiness. The world will not. You have to be the source of your own happiness. You have to find the happiness within, because your essential nature is happiness. You are that nature, but not having discovered that, we run outside and look for happiness in the world. And no matter how hard you try, the world will never make you happy. Never. So do not look for happiness in the world, just as you cannot look for milk in a wooden cow. So then the religious masters who had studied the world, actually these people, it is amazing how they were great psychologists, they were great thinkers, and they did not travel or did not do a lot of research, did not give surveys to hundreds of people. They just sat in there under the tree and meditated. And in their meditation, they came out with answers that even 8,000 years later are so relevant. And it is amazing. These people never traveled. They didn't do any market surveys, or they didn't have CNN, you know, going out and, you know, just with their meditation, they found that religion is a subjective science. All the other sciences of the world, whether it's economics or politics or chemistry or physics or mathematics, or they're all objective sciences. They change the world and they are good. I'm not trying to put down that, you know, we need economics, we need politics, we need science, chemistry, physics. They have made our life comfortable. We need that. But there is a limit to what these objective sciences can do, and that is what one has to recognize, that I can only get objective happiness from these sciences, from these philosophies. To get subjective happiness, true permanent happiness, I have to find it within. So that's why the religion, all the religions of the world say that to find true happiness, you have to go within. Even Jesus said, the kingdom of God lies within. So what he meant was that if you want to find God, look for him within. If you want to find happiness, you want to find bliss, he is within you. He is not outside. So go within and you will find this true peace and true happiness. So what do we mean by this within? Where is this within? So our scriptures tell us that we have four layers of personality, and the fifth, the core, is our true nature. So in this chart, maybe you can see it, but we have four layers: the body, the mind, the intellect, and then the vasanas or the desires. So the body is the physical body, we know. The mind is the seat of emotions. Intellect is where all the ideas and concepts live. And then vasanas are our desires, our tendencies, our character, our behavior. And majority of people live only at the body level. you know, I have to take care of my body. So to take care of my body, I have to have health, which is good. But then I have to have wealth, I have to have clothes, I have to have a house, I have to have a car, I have to have a job. All of these are just to take care of the body. I have to have my retirement so I can retire in comfort. And there is nothing wrong with that. We're not saying that one. But that is the only pursuit of majority of the people. That I have to have this, 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 and then there is no end. There is no end to the greed. There is no end to the desires. So that is majority of the people live at the level of the body. Few people live at the emotional level. You know, I should love others, so I should have somebody to love me. And yeah, the mental, emotional level, we do at a very limited level. I should have my wife should love me, my husband, my child, my brother, my sister, my friends. At the intellectual level, yeah, we want to know, we want to see on the internet what's going on, we want to read the newspaper or watch TV. But we really do not do much to fix them. We leave them at a very superficial level. So our masters tell us that yes, you have to take care of your body and you need to nourish it, eat healthy food, exercise, but do not make that the goal in life. The body is an instrument that I have been given to serve the world. And there is a very beautiful line in the Upanishad where it says that, oh Lord, whatever time you have given me on this earth, make me healthy. Healthy not so I may enjoy the pleasures, but may I serve the world, may I make this world a better place. So the body should be an instrument for service. At the mental level, I should fill my mind with good emotions of love, compassion, kindness, sharing, helping, making, you know, if I can wipe somebody's tears, somebody who is unhappy, then that is should be the goal of Swami Chinmayananda used to say, to receive love, you must become givers of love. People always say, oh, so-and-so doesn't love me. I want someone to. If you yourself love first, then that person is bound to respond. So they say, become givers of love. Do not be beggars of love. And once you give love, you will find that you will get plentiful love back in return. So they say, fill your heart and mind with positive values and share them with others. At the intellectual level, they say, read the scriptures, meet with saints. You know, at this mission, we have some wonderful speakers who come, you know, periodically. So associate with them, sit down and listen to them, learn from them, and you will find that they will change your thinking. At least for me personally, having had contact with these great saints has given me a little bit of this knowledge. Even whatever I speak every Thursday comes from the saints and acharyas of Chinmaya Mission, from their writings, from their teachings. And so as you meet and associate with them, and similarly, if you go to the church, you know, listen to the sermon, see what the priest is saying and try to understand, you will find that it will change your thinking. The way you are used to thinking will change. And there has to be a radical change in my thinking, because until now my life has all been geared towards outside, you know, looking, getting, thinking. So I have to radically transform my thinking to go inwards. So that is why they say, get the right knowledge, meet with saints, and then modify your thinking to change the direction of my life. And then at the vasana level, they say at the desire level, one has to have positive desires. Instead of only wanting for me, myself, and my family, let me think of we, you know, this whole universe, or at least if not the whole universe, maybe my community, my city, my town, you know, my state, my country. So let us do things for others, as John F. Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what I can do for my country. So that has to be the attitude, that I have to reverse the direction of my desires, where instead of wanting for me, I should give. I should give my time, I should give my service. If I have wealth, I should share my wealth. And by doing that, I will be reducing my selfishness and evolving spiritually. So at these four levels, when our personality changes, then it says that regular practice is necessary, and that is very important, because we think of religion as spirituality as being only Sunday, you know, from 10 to 11 when I go to church, I pray or I go to the temple, and the rest of the time I can, it's okay, I've done my duty towards God. Or early in the morning, you may, you know, Hindus, we do this aarti. So very quickly, in 30 seconds, I do the aarti and I'm gone. Okay, I've done my duty. Now God is happy and I'm happy. And then I don't think about him the rest of the day. So religion has to be a constant effort. It has to be 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And somebody asked Swami Chinmayananda, how long should I meditate? He said, you should meditate 24 hours a day. Which is means that I should change my life so that every action of my life becomes meditative, becomes prayer, becomes service. And it has to be constant practice. It cannot be just practicing for a few hours or for a few minutes per day. And the last point is that realize that we are all essentially divine. We are all that divinity, that purity, that knowledge, that God, we are all rays of God, just as there is one sun who has so many rays. So we are all that consciousness in every one of us has the potential to become Jesus, to become Buddha, to become Shankaracharya, to become Swami Vivekananda. We all have that potential. We have just covered it with all these other four layers which have masked our divinity. And that's why we don't act like we are divine, we act like we are ordinary, you know, selfish individuals. There was a very wonderful saint in India, in West India, in Gujarat. His name was Narsimh Mehta. He has the same last name, but no relation. And he actually gave a very beautiful poem, which gives the essence of what we spoke about today. And he said, Vaishnav jan to tene kahiye, je peed parai jani rahi. He says, who is a Vaishnav? Who is a religious person? And we think of a religious person as being one, you know, who wears an orange clothes, or maybe wears a priest's, you know, habit, or maybe somebody who goes to church 7 days a week and, you know, prays or knows all the Bible or knows the shlokas. Yeah, that is good, going to church and remembering the Lord. But that alone does not guarantee that you are a religious person. He says, who is a religious person? One who knows the sorrows of others. You cannot call yourself religious unless you know what other people's sorrows are. So we say, oh, I know that. You know, I can turn on the internet, I can Google Africa. I can say, oh, okay, in Africa, there is so many people starving. Oh, it's so terrible. You know, people are starving in Africa. Or so many people are being raped in Congo. So I know the sorrows of the world. I know how many unhappy people are there in India. I know the statistics, how many homeless in New York. And everything is available on Google. So I know, peed parai jaane re, I know the sorrow. So I am a religious person. But he said, no, that's not enough. In the third part, he says, para dukhe upkar kare. But then he or she goes out and removes the sorrows of these people. He does not just sit in his living room and Googles them, but he goes out and rolls up his sleeves and serves the world, help others to become happier. But then the fourth part of this poem, which is very beautiful, he says that this can sometimes lead to arrogance. You know, I'm such a great servant of the Lord, I have done so much to help the world. He says, but this person, mana abhimana na aane, he says he does not have even a trace of arrogance, even a trace of pride, even a trace of that he is a great servant. Why? Because the service comes to him spontaneously. Because having realized the divinity within him, this person then sees the same divinity everywhere. And when he or she is serving the world, he does not feel that I am doing a favor to anybody because they are all me. And he sees oneness in all. And so for such a person, the service is spontaneous. And so when there is spontaneous service, then how can there be arrogance? Like if my foot is hurting and if I massage my foot, I don't say, I'm such a great yogi, you know, I help my foot. No, the foot is me. So if I massage it, it is me. So same way for such a person who serves the world, for him service comes spontaneously because he does not think anybody separate from me. He helps everybody. Talking about help reminds me of the story. There was this Boy Scout, and he came to his mother. He said, "Mom, today I did my act of service. You know, Boy Scouts are supposed to help the world every day, at least do one good act. Mom, I did my good deed today." So she says, "Yeah, what did you do?" He says, "I helped this poor old lady to cross the street." So mother said, "Oh, that's very nice, very nice. What did she say? Was she happy?" He said, "No, she wasn't happy." So mother said, "Why?" He says, "Because she didn't want to cross the street." So that is not the service. Service is where I find a genuine need, and where even that idea that I'm serving is not there. Why? Because such a person has no ego, has no arrogance, because he or she considers themselves an instrument of the Lord, that the Lord is working through me. Whatever I have is his gift to me, and what I do with that is my gift to the Lord. So I serve the world, but not out of arrogance, not out of pride, not out of ego, but out of a spontaneous love. See, for most of us, love is an effort. You know, I love this person, I don't love this person, I like him, I dislike. But for the saints, love was spontaneous because they saw themselves, that I am there in all, because they are all that one divinity. Just as I have been created by the Lord, they are all his creation. So a person like a part may say, "I am different from that part because that is bigger, I am smaller, and I'm yellow, and that is blue, and that is green." But when the part knows that they are all nothing but mud, I am composed of mud, and all the parts in the world are composed of mud, they are all me, and there is no difference. Small part, big part, green part, yellow part, blue part. So a wise person understands that there is only one consciousness everywhere. There is only one God. You can call him by different names. And with that understanding, he or she then sees the world as me. And for him or her, the service becomes. So that is the essential knowledge of Vedanta, that you are all divine. You are all children of that one God. And every one of you is perfect. Every one of us is perfect. Let us discover that divinity with us, within us. And meditation is the most powerful technique, because in meditation, when we quieten the mind, we go inward, and in that silence, you feel that presence, you feel that divinity, you feel that power, you feel that peace. And that is why here in this class, we try to promote this idea of regular daily morning meditation, because that is a very wonderful way to discover that divinity, which is our true nature. Swami Chinmayananda says, immortality is your birthright. You, by nature, you are immortal. You are not this mortal body. This mortal body you will drop. But in fact, you are that consciousness which is ever indestructible, which is ever permanent. And remember that, and then function in the world. And then the world cannot affect you. And you will be the master of the world. The world will not be your master. This is the beautiful message. I hope I was able to convey that.
This concludes this segment of Impact with Dr. Anil Mehta. Join us again next time.